My name's Howard Olson, and this is a session on natural resources, who's in charge. I'd like to, before we begin, tell you that this is not just a lecture, this is a discussion group. So as we go along, we'll spend a few minutes in the beginning talking about the various jurisdictions over our natural resources, and we'll talk about wilderness, and then we want to discuss all these things, but we can discuss it all while we're going along. But it helps in the discussion if we rather know each other and know where we're from and our particular interest in natural resources. For any of you who are in the lumber business, that helps too, because it helps me. Do you want to start and give your name, where you're from?
Dave Teets from near Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas, good.
I'm Jennings Torgelson from Appleton, Minnesota. I lived on a farm and operated for 50 years and also a supervisor of our local soil and water district.
Your local what?
Supervisor of our local soil and water district.
Soil and water district, good. Yeah?
Lillian Lowe from San Diego. My father, many years ago, dealt in lumber.
Okay, good.
And I'm interested now because several of my grandchildren are very active in preserving the natural resources.
Okay. So they're probably thinking about the same things we're talking about here.
Yes.
Yeah. My name is Linda, and I'm from the Central Oregon coast.
Okay.
And I work for a large timber company, and then still do volunteer work for people that own small woodlands and also American Paper.
Which timber company you work for?
It was called Publisher Paper. We were owned by Los Angeles Times.
Sure. Luann Halgren from Fargo, North Dakota.
Okay.
No connection with natural resources, but all right. Interest.
Be connected when you get down here.
Cassandra Howe from Seattle, Washington. And just interest.
You're a student here?
Yeah.
Okay.
My name is Emily, and I live at Holden Village. And so that's kind of why I'm interested, because I live here.
You live here?
I live here, in the woods.
Okay.
I'm Lee Sellerud, and I'm from Minnesota.
And you got to tell us what part of Minnesota, because Minnesota
has... Minneapolis.
Minneapolis, oh. Okay.
And I have just kind of always been interested in the environment and stuff.
Sure, good. Okay, the back.
I'm Cal Bergram, and this is my wife, Dee. We live in Russell, South Dakota, and we're farmers.
Okay, any big questions on resource out there?
No.
You just came in. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Oh, sure. My name's Dan Borba, and I'm from Tacoma.
Tacoma. Well, we got a good geographical distribution here. I gave a talk a few years ago, and the reason I got trained on how to be sure you know who's in the room is that I had a person from the Sierra Club here, and an executive of the Warehouse of Timber Company here. And they didn't agree on anything I said, so I had a no-win situation. Today, I think we've got a nice moderate group, and we can talk about various aspects of this. What kind of brought this subject to mind was that I've been coming up to Holden now. My wife and I just figured out for 30 years. We came first in 1967, and now it's 97. And we've come here. She's an artist. She's been the artist in residence and things like that. And her children are young. They came and stayed with us for a week or two at a time. And over the years, we became more and more familiar with the whole Pacific Northwest, of course. My youth, after I graduated forestry school, I worked on the Olympic Peninsula for the U.S. Forest Service. And as you say right here now, it's a great area. I've often wondered why I ever left there, but I did and went back to the Middle West and led my life. But even there, in those early days, which is now 50 years ago, there was a big battle raging between the National Forest and the National Park. And then as I became more interested in what was going around up here in Lake Chelan and the North Cascades, I could see there were these many different, what I call, jurisdictions. And then I began reading about various things that go on here, and about 7 or 8 years ago, it kind of reached a little peak about people talking that there should be one over umbrella organization to run all of these various jurisdictions we have here. And I'm going to ask you to participate with me, because I'll put down a sheet here that breaks this out a little bit. But before we get into that, I'd like to talk for a minute or two. About the difference of the various parts of government. People ask you, you know, and they say, oh, you're forestry, you work for the Forest Service. They don't realize that the Forest Service is under Department of Agriculture. That's why I kind of set this up. I'd like to have you kind of help me. Different things. Department of Agriculture, Department of Interior, together they control a very vast amount of all the national resources in the United States. But along with them are two other elements. Each state has their own park system and their own forest. And we've got a lot of land that's given to the military. So the Forest Service under the Department of Agriculture control the national forests, Forest Products Laboratory. They do great amounts of research on both wildlife and trees and forest management. And the Department of Interior has a national park system. Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Indian Affairs, Fish and Wildlife Service, and kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it, that there's going to be cross interests in everything they do. Take a subject like water quality. They're all interested in the quality of the water and the proportion of water, where it's going, where it's coming from, and how it flows, and so. That's the first breakdown. Second breakdown is each state.
Which department would be in control of, for example, range land that's kept for cattle ranchers on government property?
Bureau of Land Management.
Land Management.
And you'd think that'd be the Department of Agriculture, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs. I do a lot of work. I work at Augsburg College. I guess I didn't tell you that. And I'm in their development department. And we have a lot of Indian tribes in Minnesota, about 10 or 11 of them. And part of my work is to deal with the Indian liaison. We train Indians in our college. And same thing there. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is under the Department of Interior. And they're such a lesser part of that department, they get rather overshadowed. Just to give you another thing to think about, a few years ago, my friend Bob Herbst was Deputy Director of the Department of the Interior when Carter was president. And I was in Washington, spent a day with him, and he showed me through the department, told me about their own private Air Force, they're doing all the things they need to do. And at the end of the day, I said, well, what is the budget of the Department of the Interior to engulf all of these things? Oh, he says it's right around $9 billion a year. Probably by now it might be $15 billion. But think of that when we spend national defense $297 billion. So that gives you some thinking about where the priorities are in the national administration of the USA. Well, then if you drop down to the states, about every state I know has the Department of Natural Resources, they call it the DNR. How is that in California? Is that the way it's handled in California too?
I have a lot of different organizations.
Yeah.
My daughter is a botanist, and she does environmental impact studies for the California Highway System, some of the counties, and some of the people who want to build dams and have to replace what they destroy. And some of it is good, and some of the reports are pretty sad.
That's a pretty important part of any project now, anywhere. That and then the archaeological studies of Indian artifacts and sacred grounds, things like that. Very important. But most states have a Department of Natural Resources, and under the Department of Natural Resources, in Minnesota, I think there are 7 different agencies that work under the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Started with parks, forests, trails, waterways, streams, wildlife, enforcement. All those various aspects come under the Department of Natural Resources in the state. One of the things that brings all this to my attention, why I'm pleased to be able to talk to you about it, is there's going to be less and less land that will be in the public use. In Minnesota, we have this problem because every time there's a good scenic overlook or something, a developer wants to get a hold of it and put up condominiums or high-rise of some type. And if you don't save the land now, you know, it's gone, sort of gone forever. I'm a member of a citizens group called Minnesota Parks and Trails Council, and we seek out places that would make a natural for a state park. And we buy it in advance as a state because to get us through the state legislation takes 2 or 3 years. And we get a chance to hold it until the state has passed all the legislation it takes to make it a state park. And then we're able to sell it to the state for whatever we have in it. But Minnesota, for instance, has 65 state parks. And the states of Michigan, Wisconsin have about the same number. I think Washington has something like 55 or so. What about Oregon? Somebody more?
Quite a few more.
How many?
Quite a few more, yeah. But I don't have the total number.
I mean, it'd be in the 90s. But now, when you think of all of those different related uses of public land, and then think of all the bureaucracies that are not really in conflict, but they're not really complementary to each other all the time either. And that's why this issue of the this area we're living in right now came up. I've listed a few of the jurisdictions here, but I want you to help me think of some more. We're in the Wenatchee National Forest, and then we're, if you walk down the trail here a mile, you'll come to Science's Glacier Peak Wilderness area. And then coming off the lake, there's a Lake Chelan Recreation Area. There's a state park, and there's a North Cascades National Park. That was put in 1968, which wasn't too long ago, really. Now there's about 2 or 3 other jurisdictions. Any of you think of, can you think of any right offhand?
Where does the wilderness area come in?
That comes in here in this Glacier Peak wilderness, which is a very large wilderness. And what you find is the, when they'll take part of a national forest and declare it to be a wilderness area, that changes the composition quite a bit. Not the composition, but it changes what can be done because there's no logging in a wilderness area. And we have a big wilderness area in Minnesota called the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, which is 1 million acres. And many restrictions there, like using motorized vehicles and motorized boats, and you can't land airplanes on the lake. They used to fly in on an airplane and fish for a while and fly out again. You can't do that anymore. And that's been in existence now 25 years. And just recently, I don't know if you've been back home to Minnesota lately, but there's a lot of pressure to change it. The resort owners want to get back in there and allow motorized boats, motorized trucks over to the between the lakes to bring people one lake to another. So you get a lot of controversy. Yes.
See, if you have a hiker in the wilderness area out here, we're not allowed to bring in a vehicle unless we get a special permit.
Is this state or federal? The one here?
Well, right, wilderness. Yeah, right here. I mean, that's how close it can come to somebody going, but they're hurt and they need to be quick evacuation. You go, you can't.
I got to tell you another personal one about. I suppose this was 15 years ago. We had our children here. We had 4 children. And we went down to the lake and we hiked up to Donkey. I don't know if any of you hiked up to Donkey or not. Have you hiked to Donkey? Hike? It's a nice hike. It's about 2 miles, I think, and you know, it's all climbing, and took us a couple of 3 hours. Kids were all tired. As soon as we got there, guy came by on a motorcycle, zip, zip, zip. It took him about 10 minutes, and it was so discouraging to us. Think that here's this motorcycle after our hard work to get up here. But that's the reason you have that, so that
right.
You keep the solitude or non-motorized. I'd recommend any of you who haven't been to Donkey Lake, you get a chance to go there. It's really a nice lake to hike into. There's good fishing there, and that's out of the wilderness area. And out of, I think it's out of the forest, too. I just want to read you a couple of lines here about what wilderness is and what the... This is a National Geographic from 1988 of the big Yellowstone fire. You all remember hearing about that. That was interesting. I was up here at the time that fire was going on, and I think anybody lived out west, I think, could see some smoke from that Yellowstone fire. That was one of the all-time big fires. This is also a National Geographic dealing with our national forests. And this is from 1982. National Forest Problems in Paradise. The wealth of sylvan beauty and other natural resources, America's national forests, are set aside to best meet the needs of the American people. How this is done is a big question, a rising debate. And just the first, there's a lot of good pictures of what's happening in the national forest, but just a paragraph here says, an Indian said, I could never own a forest, even though the deed may be in my name, and I think this is the Indian in me. But that forest owns me, I have no doubt, for I have been making pilgrimages to those forests summoned by every change of season, as far back as my memory goes. So when I write of national forests, I confess that in any tug of loyalties, I am for the trees. And I'll put it up here now, but one of the issues we can talk about today is which is more important, the forest or the trees? And that's the big debate that goes on all the time. But allowable cuts and what we should be doing with the forest that we have. And many of these set-asides that we have here are with the thought in mind to preserve them from being logged off or diminished or used in a manner that is destructive. I know in the state park system in Minnesota they have many, many regulations on what can be done and what can't be done in a state park. And that's all good because it keeps its natural beauty as much as possible. The other factor that's impacting all of the national parks, and you always read about Yosemite, is that they're being overused now. We wear them out if we use them too much. So as good as it is, it's too much of a good thing maybe. In Minnesota, on this Boundary Waters canoe area I mentioned to you, they've reduced the size of the trips from 12 people down to 9 people. And the campsites, they have to have them set aside so they can restore themselves. And you have to get a reservation really weeks or months in advance to get a chance to go on a trip. And that area attracts people from all over the United States. So that many, many people want to use it. And Yosemite does the same thing. And Grand Canyon National Park. In Minnesota, they wanted to have a national park, and it took a lot of effort and 10 years of diligent work on the part of many committees. They now have the Voyageurs National Park, which is to the far north, also along the border near International Falls. And there again, there's a lot of controversy about using mechanized vehicles like snowmobiles. Snowmobiling is very big in the Midwest, Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, and we have literally hundreds and hundreds of miles of snowmobile trails in those states for people that can get out, get deeper into the wilderness they could otherwise and enjoy it. Anybody think of any other jurisdictions here? Let's just ask a question. You think this would be more effective or more efficient? We had one big umbrella organization rather than have seven or eight bureaucracies all working on the same type of thing. Think of it also in the Christian context.
It would be good if there were just one, you could just get them to agree.
Yeah. Get one that would agree on all of the aspects or ramifications of all the different things.
One of the problems with if they were all together is that whatever organization that would be would have a tremendous amount of power.
A lot of pressure on them.
So I'm saying they would have a tremendous amount of power.
Yeah.
And and that some of the conflicts that arise right now over over whose land is it, where you have private property that has been maybe in the family for generations, and then all of a sudden somebody decides it's wetlands, and they've been farming it for years and years, and for generations now they can't farm it anymore because somebody decided it's called wetland because once every 100 years it floods or something like that. And that if you have an organization that's able to wield that kind of power, that can be misused.
That's a big new issue in Minnesota, North Dakota.
Yeah, I think we see that, and you are familiar with the Department of Natural Resources, and basically the only handle you have on them is your state legislature.
Right.
And if you are, if this is something that's really, one-sided as far as your environment or your people are concerned, it's very difficult to have a meeting of minds because you've got to go through the state legislature to basically get it corrected.
That's right. That shows you, what a bureaucracy, yeah. Like you said, what you have to do to get anything changed is amazing now. The chances of getting changed aren't too good, I guess, to put it that way.
Well, there's no handle on, it seemed like that's the end of the supervision or the authority. It kind of ends by itself and in itself, except through legislation. And it's too time-consuming to...
Yeah.
I guess in our local, we work with wetlands, we work with animal predator control, deer control. We are, there's many aspects that in our rural agriculture land, our resources, water, all of it are there. And plus forests, even in Minnesota, your oak forests.
I thought what you mentioned earlier about the power, and I've been reading a lot about water too. Water, especially out west here, is just the real issue. It's going to be bigger and bigger as years go on. And in fact, water is sort of the big factor below all of these things we're talking about here, because it's so basic to exist.
Whoever controls the water controls the land, yeah. And how it can be used.
And if you've ever forded the Colorado River down in Mexico with a two-wheel drive vehicle, you know what the United States has done to the Colorado River.
That's where you end up, huh?
Yeah, I've done
portable.
That. Yeah. Ported it with a two-wheel drive vehicle.
Mm. The girls, your students follow that? All the water's been used by the time it hits Mexico. And that's an international problem.
And nothing grows in that. This is a number of years ago, it might be different now, but there wasn't any growing vegetation in that backwater on that river.
Uh-huh.
It was that salty.
Oh.
And then you wonder why the Mexican people were, a little perturbed at the
sure.
United States, for this is one of their main sources of water, too. And I had the privilege of going duck hunting back in this abandoned farmland because that water was that salty. It was abandoned and you...
How were the ducks eating?
Very dry. basically, we shot some ducks, but we gave them to the natives.
Oh, yeah. Good.
One of the problems is also dealing with the big companies.
Okay.
Who has the power to make the decisions? My daughter lives in Northern California in the Redwood Country. And they're just, people are all at each other's throats practically because some big company, logging companies, mm-hmm. want to cut down.
Sure.
And the people say, and some are under state government, some are national parks, who's going to get permission to cut down these 300-year-old trees? Mm-hmm. And even if you replant, you won't have much.
Not for a couple hundred years, anyhow. Now, the Redwood debate is a big one. And
yes,
it's been going on for a long
yeah.
time. I think I remember Save the Redwoods League when I was in college. Years ago, they talked about Save the Redwoods.
And I used to live in Louisiana for a while, and you know, there it's seen from a different perspective, because there are some of the logging companies and paper companies own huge tracts of land. But because growing season there is so long with southern pines, that the harvesting cycle is about 30 years.
Sure.
Compared to hundreds of years up in the Northwest.
I think Weyerhaeuser owns about half the state of Arkansas. Run to Queen, they bought out the Dirks Lumber Company many years ago, and mm-hmm. Dirks owned a great part of Arkansas. But as far as public lands go, the private ownership shouldn't make that much difference, except as you're saying, the big corporations bring influence to
yes.
release some of that. And that's the same thing here with, you read in the newspapers about declaring wilderness, you know,
yes.
more forest in the wilderness, and that stops the logging. And the last greatest one you heard about was in Alaska. They put aside 3 million acres up there not too long ago, and that just takes all the logging out of there, and naturally the timber companies rise up and dispute that very heavily.
And some of them have a lot of power.
Yeah.
Financial power.
Well, that's it.
And wilderness also means, in like for Alaska, then no oil drilling too.
That's right. But there's a firm that wants to drill right on the margins of Yellowstone National Park. They've got drilling rights and everything, and there's where the matter of ethics comes up, or Christian responsibility, because many of the wildlife that use the park also use the areas around it. And the Nature Conservancy in recent years, now they've been talking to us a lot about state parks. The areas around the state parks are almost as valuable because it's the whole, the management of the bio, it's all involved and all interrelated. And that's why the same thing here, you get, you know, the animals don't stop at a jurisdictional boundary, they just keep mm-hmm. moving around. It's like campers, yes.
There's kind of an interesting thing too, for instance in Oregon, when you have the set-asides and then you have the diseased timber and the dead timber that make this nice fuel, so that when you have a lightning strike, and then you've created quite a bit of problem because, you know, the wind damage, and then pretty soon you've got a fire that's going right into homes, right into, you know, managed forests, all because we had the set-aside with no ability to go in and pull out the dead and dying timber.
That was a big debate, you know, on this Yellowstone fire was they had 50 years of fuel laying on the ground there. And the big argument or the debate there is about what they call, you know, backfiring or fire control by using fire as a mechanism.
Right. Or even here in Leavenworth 3 years ago, that simply was an issue. There was way mm-hmm. too much fuel yeah. on the floor, and it was part of it was set aside.
And there are a lot of good points on both sides of the mm-hmm. debate.
Yeah, it's complex. It's certainly not simple.
Even in endangered species, after the Yellowstone fire, now it's growing back somewhat. It's, what, 10 years now. They found two or three plant species that had been considered gone.
Well, and you'll find that in Mount St. Helens, too.
Is that right?
So many felt that would never come back. And that was 18 years ago here. And the beauty there, and the wildflowers, the wildlife that came back has been astounding.
See, that's the problem with politicians, too. They can't see beyond 2 years or 4 years, whatever it is they're running for. You talk to them about a forest plan or a management plan, it's 25, 50, or 30 years, you said, in Louisiana. They don't think that far ahead. They only get reelected. Somebody else had their hand up. Oh, you did.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was going to say that when I was in the Redwoods this summer, and they were thinking about, like, they were discussing whether to have, like, a controlled fire through the area to keep the forest grail, like, clear of, like litter, what they call it, like, all the dead brush and stuff. That's really good for, like, a big, that would be a potential for a big, big fire.
Well, they do get away once in a while, but in the Redwoods they don't as much, but in a lot of lesser sized trees where they try to control fire, and once in a while one will get away from it.
Where in all of this do we put our expanded number of people?
Anybody want to answer that? Some of your kids are in high school and might have an answer for us. Populations are growing. Well, California, they said in a few years it'll be up to 30 million people. And therefore they need water in the cities of Los Angeles and San Francisco. People are not moving out of the land, are they? They're moving into the metropolitan urban centers. In recent years, urban forestry has come way up. Urban forestry is a big science now, you may know. Planning, a very important part of all this population in the big cities. And all of you know, wherever you live, you've seen the city just keep moving out and out and out and get bigger and bigger and bigger. And we've got a problem. I have another talk we give in a couple of days here about the vanishing forest and the need for timber. And the families are getting smaller and the houses are getting bigger. We can't continue that way because we haven't got enough wood to keep building all these huge housing shelters for small and real small families. Yes.
A couple things. One is, you know, what you're saying there, that there's a whole new industry coming out now of steel structures. You know, instead of using 2x4s for your for the studs in the walls and so on, they're coming out with a stamped steel 2x4 that you're using extensively. The other thing of growing population and environmental concerns in the Austin, Texas area, west of the city of Austin is what they call the Hill Country, and it is semi-arid, rolling hills, kind of scrubby trees. Has very little agricultural value, but it's pretty, and it's environmentally sensitive. And so there are all kinds of limits placed on development west of Austin, and you just have to go through a whole...
Housing development?
Yeah, housing developments and so on, that kind of development. There's all kinds of restrictions put on on building there. At the same time, to the east of Austin, because of the geological formations there and so on, east of Austin is some of the richest farmland in the country.
Yeah.
But there are no regulations over that.
Well,
so where are the people moving to then? Well, where are the houses going? They're taking good farmland, good productive farmland, making it into subdivisions, neighborhoods. In the meantime, this scrubby land that's not good for anything except it's beautiful.
Mesquite.
And that's being protected.
That would you grow in mesquite?
Yeah. and that's being protected. Yeah. Whereas the farmland is not, some of the farmers there follow the fact that a million acres of good farmland in this country is lost every year. Development, and pretty soon who's going to be producing the food?
That's right. That's a big issue.
And so
you buy it at the grocery store.
Right, but on one hand, we're protecting some insect or some bird or some frog or whatever, and limiting development there. In the meantime, using up who knows how many acres of good productive farmland.
Yeah, those are some of the things we really faced, and I think as Christians, we land use is really going to be a problem in the years ahead. I have the same thing. My daughter lives in southern Wisconsin. We see Walmart comes in and takes over a 40-acre farm and builds a parking lot over half of it and a big warehouse over the other half. And they build another huge distribution center nearby. And that's going on everywhere. As you say, 1 million acres a year, no small amount. I'd like to have you think a minute about this other aspect here. In your congregation, do you ever have adult forums or anything? You talk about these issues that are facing us in the future, about what can Christians do, or how can they make their ethical standards brought to the fore and get into the debate? These debates are going on everywhere. And what part should they be taking? One fellow said, who speaks for the church in all these matters? Anybody have any profundities they want to share with us?
Don't get much reaction. Don't get any. We in the soils districts have soil stewardship. You know, one Sunday designated, then you're lucky if you get any reaction at all. If they get the material used, maybe, maybe not. It's not something that a lot of places is.
Congregations don't get stirred up about it. No. They just kind of accept what's happening. I was president of Keep Minnesota Green many years ago, and I've been involved in the tree farm system over the years. And the total of small acreages all over America are more than the big industrial forests and many of the national forests in acreage. And that is a big input every year, and we face there again all of the taxation. If you plant a 40 or 80 or a couple hundred acres, and the more it grows up, the more valuable it appears. So the tax assessor raises your taxes on that plot a little more. And, you know, the way to come out is to cut it down and sell the timber. So we've been making adjustments on that in a number of states so that it stays stable. But don't you think that somewhere along the way this is going to get serious enough that someone will have to speak for the church, and our church organization, Christian people, will have to make themselves heard?
We had a small church in where I live needed to expand the parking lot, and there were trees on the church property that had to come down. And the adjoining neighbors were just really upset. Uh-huh. And that was just like, our minister was out there going, we have got to have a bigger parking lot. These are our trees. They got to come down. We can't have both those trees in that parking lot, and it's been defined clearly that we simply can't be parking all over the neighborhood. But
there's trade-offs in all of it.
Yeah, so that was just like right there, sitting right in front of you. It wasn't an issue that was removed. It was right there on the church property.
I was out in New York State a couple years ago, and they have 3 million acres in the middle of upstate New York that's been under law since 1910. And even if you own the land, anything you do with the land, as far as tree cutting, everything, you have to have a certain process, get permission. There's more standing timber in New York State today than there was in 1910, per square foot basis and everything. People are amazed at some of those stats that come out. And you know, you'll hear numbers like they'll say, well, there's more timber growing every year than is cut, but the growing is on small stems, not on the big trees that are cut down. So it takes a long time before you get to what they call merchantable log sizes and replanting. Well, what do you think is the most important, the forest or the tree? The timber industry naturally is looking for the tree. You gotta cut that up. As you say, there are many wood substitutes coming in now. I made my whole livelihood for 35 years working with Western Red Cedar utility poles. And my part of it was to provide chemicals that were impregnated into those poles so they wouldn't decay or rot or get attacked by termites. And my chemical was one of the bad boys, full of dioxins, pentachlorophenol, been outlawed. And many of the poles that we use that way now are made of steel and concrete, aluminum structures. You'll see less and less wood poles and more of these other materials being used everywhere. So that's sort of what's happening. There's a trend. Plus, in lumber, the price of lumber is going sky high because it costs more. So then you get around, why are we selling everything to Japan, shipping all our logs over there, cutting down our forests? That's another question.
I was out to Seattle a few years ago, and as a Midwesterner, this was at the time when we walked into the airport and they were having placards on the back of some people walking back and forth, spotted owl or toilet paper. Mm-hmm. But the thing that really irritated me when I drove up towards in the northwest there, where they had clear cut the land, there was like a storm across the highway of Canadian thistle seed. This, where they had clear cut, and back in our country, that's a noxious weed. You got to take care of it.
Yeah, by law.
Yeah. And here, I don't know how or why or you know what, but it looked to me like, you know, there's a better way of managing that than what they had done, some way or other.
Part of that is a species. Douglas fir, to regenerate, needs sunlight.
It does.
And if you selected log Douglas fir with the idea you're going to replant in that forest, well, you don't have enough sunlight. But the clear cuts out west are more apparent because it's up on the mountainside. Yes. You can see it. We could clear cut Minnesota, but we leave 300 feet on both sides of the highway, and people run along in a big delusion that they're in the forest of northern Minnesota. And that's part of the difference. But clear cutting is getting a lot of examination now, right? Mm-hmm. And many of the timber companies, too, are doing many things different. Warehouses, for instance, they're managing their tracks better than the U.S. government is by far. They've got super trees coming up. They've got seed sources that are checked out. They fertilize. They do many things. They're going to be growing more timber faster per acre than anybody else is. They're doing it already. Yeah. And their harvest cycles and rotations are well calculated. Yes.
We have a role as consumers too to reduce our demand for paper products. One example would be bags at the grocery store.
Sure.
I just saw an ad on TV where all the major timber companies were encouraging you to use newspaper bags.
Reusable bag, yeah.
And, you know, that's in their best interest, but it's not really in the best interest of the forest when you can bring in your own bag or just carry them out. You don't need to use a tree at all, you know. And so I think, and, you know, using recycled paper products, you know.
It's interesting reading that they claim that the computerization of everything is going to eliminate tons and tons of needed office paper. In fact, a friend of mine works for an insurance company. They don't want to see any files anymore. They want it all on the computers. But to counteract that, as the third world countries come along and start using Kleenex, for instance, that's going to put up the demand. So the world demand for paper products keeps going up, but it is changing. There's a great change occurring there.
And we're the big consumers, I think.
Oh, by far.
I mean, I don't know how much control we have over the major corporations, but at least we have control over what we do individually.
Well, it's great. You know, we don't have the kind of control we need. My friend Bob Bigger was a forester and a production guy, and he became vice president of the Burlington Northern. The Burlington has 2 million acres of the forest, and he was managing that just beautifully. He had the replanting, the right seed sources, different altitudes, and everything under control. They went through a management change, the new president got in there, and his balance sheet looked bad, or his operating statement 1 year, starts harvesting to make, selling off timber that was only half mature, you know, all kinds of things like this. So that's the kind of thing, when you talk about our industry, where do you kind of build into these things? And a lot of that has to be ethical. People have to have a feel for it. And that's where I think the church comes in too. Well, we're near the time and the close, and I think you were here the other day when I told that story about St. Peter, weren't you?
I don't know.
Anyhow, the story about St. Peter. He had a group of people came into heaven one day, and he was showing them around, and everything was Glorious. And one person says, what about those people behind that big barricade over there and that big fence around them? What about them? And St. Peter says, oh, they're from Holden Village. They keep trying to go home on the weekends. Thank you very much.